asked, "Swiss? Why is he acting so aggressively, then?" Trombonist began a flatulent Beethoven's fifth, also in wrong key. E's voice was one degree off absolute zero. "I think you're ill, Robert. You should leave now." Grégoire, the Swiss fiancé, and the butler each clamped one of my unresisting shoulders and marched me backwards to the doorway through the herd. High, high above, I glimpsed two small vis-de-vis in their nightcaps, peering down the stairwell through the landing railings like night-capped gargoylettes. Winked at 'em. Gleam of triumph in my rival's lovely, long-lashed eyes, and his accented, "Go home to England," ignited Frobisher the Rotter, sorry to say. Just as I was flung over the threshold, I embraced Grégoire in a rugger grip, determined that smug cockatoo was coming with me. Birds of paradise in the hallway shrieked, baboons roared. Down the steps we bounced. No, we thudded, slipped, swore, thumped, and tore. Grégoire cried in alarm, then pain, the very medicine prescribed by Dr. Vengeance. Stone steps and icy pavements bruised my own flesh as black as his, banged my elbows and hips just as hard, but at least mine was not the only ruined evening in Bruges, and I yelled, kicking his ribs once for each word before half running, half hobbling off on my whacked ankle. Love hurts! I'm in better spirits now. Hardly remember what he even looks like. Once her face was burned into my idiotic eyes, saw her everywhere, in everyone. Grégoire has exquisite fingers, long and pliant. Franz Schubert maimed his hands by tying weights to 'em. He thought it'd increase his range at the keyboard. Majestic string quartets, but what a bloody fool. Grégoire, on the other hand, possesses perfect hands by birth, but probably doesn't know a crotchet from crochet. 6 or 7 days later. Forgot about this unfinished letter. Well, half forgot. It got buried under my piano MS, and too busy composing to fish it out. Icy seasonal weather. Half the clocks in Bruges have frozen fast. So, now you know about Eva. The affair horrored me out, but what, pray, resounds in hollows? Music, Sixsmith. Let there be music, and behold! During a 6-hour fireside bath last night, I scored 102 bars of a funereal march based on Ode to Joy for my clarinetist. Another visitor this morning. Haven't been this popular since that notorious day at the Derby. Awoken at noon by a friendly but firm knock-knock-knock, called out, "Who's there?" "Verplanke." Couldn't recognize the name, but when I opened the door, there stood my musical policeman, the one who had lent me the bicycle in my old life. "May I come in? Je pensais vous rendre une visite de courtoisie." "Most certainly," I replied, adding rather wittily, "Voilà qui est bien courtois pour un policier." Cleared him an armchair and offered to ring for tea, but my visitor declined. Couldn't quite conceal his surprise at the untidiness. Explain how I tipped the maids to stay away. Can't abide having my MS touched. Monsieur Verplanque nodded in sympathy, then wondered why a gentleman might check into his hotel under a pseudonym. "An eccentricity inherited from my father," I said. "A notable in public life who prefers to keep his private one private. Keep my own vocation similarly, hush-hush, so I'm not put upon to tinkle the ivories during cocktail hour. Refusals cause offence." V seemed satisfied with my explanation. "A luxurious home away from home, Le Royal." He glanced around my sitting room. "I did not know amanuenses were so well paid." Admitted what the tactful fellow doubtless already knew. Ayres and I had parted company, adding I have my own independent income, which a mere 12 months ago would have been the truth. "Ah, a bicycling millionaire," he smiled. "Tenacious, isn't he?" "Not quite a millionaire," I smiled back, "but, providentially, a man of sufficient consequence to afford Le Royal." He got to the point at last. "You've made an influential enemy during your short residency in our city, Monsieur Frobisher. A certain manufacturer, I think we both know of whom I speak, made a complaint to my superior about an incident a few nights ago. His secretary, a very fine harpsichordist in our little group, in fact, recognized your name and deflected the complaint to my desk. So here I am." Took pains to assure him it was all an absurd misunderstanding over a young lady's affections. Charming fellow nodded. "I know, I know. In youth, one's heart plays più fortissimo than the head. Our difficulty is the young man's father is banker for several of our city elders, and is making unpleasant noises about charging you with battery and assault. Thanked Monsieur Verplank for his warning and tact, and promised to keep a lower profile from now on. Alas, not so simple. Monsieur Frobisher, don't you think our city intolerably cold in winter? Don't you think Mediterranean climes might better inspire your muse? Asked if the banker's anger might be appeased if I gave my word to leave Bruges within 7 days, after my sextet's final revision. V thought yes, such an understanding should defuse the situation. So I gave my word, as a gentleman, to make the necessary arrangements. Business concluded, V asked if he might have a preview of my sextet. Showed him the clarinet cadenza. He was unnerved at first by its spectral and structural peculiarities, but spent a further hour asking perceptive questions about my semi-invented notation and the singular harmonics of the piece. As we shook hands, he gave me his card, urged me to post a published copy of the score for his ensemble, and expressed regret that his public persona had had to impinge upon his private one. I was sorry to see him go. Writing is such a damn lonely sickness. So you see, I must put my final days to good account. Don't worry about me, Sixsmith. I'm quite well, and far too busy for melancholia. There's a sailor's tavern at the end of the street where I could find companionship if I chose. One catches salty boys going in and out at any hour. But only music matters to me now. Music clatters, music swells, music tosses. Sincerely, R.F. Hotel Memling, Bruges. 4:15 in the morning, 12/12/1931. Sixsmith. Shot myself through the roof of my mouth at 5 a.m. this morning, with V.A.'s Luger. But I saw you, my dear, dear fellow. How touched I am that you care so much. On the belfry's lookout yesterday at sunset. Sheerest fluke you didn't see me first. Had got to that last flight of stairs when I saw a man in profile leaning on the balcony, gazing at the sea. Recognized your natty gabardine coat, your one and only Trilby. One more step up, you'd have seen me crouching in the shadows. You strolled to the north side. One turn my way, I would have been rumbled. Watched you for as long as I dared. A minute, before pulling back and hot-footing it down to earth. Don't be cross. Thank you ever so for trying to find me. Did you come on the Kentish Queen? Questions rather pointless now, aren't they? Wasn't the sheerest fluke I saw you first? Not really. World's a shadow theatre, an opera, and such things writ large in its libretto. Don't be too cross at my role. You couldn't understand, no matter how much I explained. You're a brilliant physicist. Your Rutherford chap et al. Agree you've got a brilliant future. Quite sure they're right. But in some fundamentals you're a dunce. The healthy can't understand the emptied, the broken. You'd try to list all the reasons for living, but I left them behind at Victoria Station back in early summer. Reason I crept back down from the Belvedere was that I can't have you blaming yourself for failing to dissuade me. You may, anyway, but don't, Sixsmith, don't be such an ass. Likewise, hope you weren't too disappointed to find me gone from the Royal. The manager got wind of Monsieur Verplanck's visit. Obliged to ask me to leave, he said, on account of heavy bookings. Piffle. But I took the fig leaf. Frobisher the stinker wanted a tantrum, but Frobisher the composer wanted peace and quiet to finish my sextet. Paid in full. Bang went the last Yansh money, and packed my valise. Wandered crooked alleys and crossed icy canals before coming across this deserted-looking caravansary. A reception, a rarely manned nook under the stairs. Only ornament in my room, a monstrous laughing cavalier, too ugly to steal and sell. From my filthy window one sees the very same dilapidated old windmill on whose steps I napped on my first morning in Bruges. The very same. Fancy that. Around we go. Knew I'd never see my 25th birthday. Am early for once. The lovelorn, the cry for helpers, all mawkish tragedians who give suicide a bad name are the idiots who rush it like amateur conductors. A true suicide is a paced, disciplined certainty. People pontificate, suicide is selfishness. Career churchmen like Peter go a step further and call it a cowardly assault on the living. Oafs argue this specious line for various reasons, to evade fingers of blame, to impress one's audience with one's mental fibre, to vent anger, or just because one lacks the necessary suffering to sympathise. Cowardice is nothing to do with it. Suicide takes considerable courage. Japanese have the right idea. No, what's selfish is to demand another to endure an intolerable existence, just to spare families, friends, and enemies a bit of soul-searching. The only selfishness lies in ruining strangers' days by forcing them to witness a grotesqueness. So I'll make a thick turban from several towels to muffle the shot and soak up the blood and do it in the bathtub, so it shouldn't stain any carpets. Last night I left a letter under the manager's day office door. He'll find it at 8 AM tomorrow, informing him of the change in my existential status, so with luck an innocent chambermaid will be spared an unpleasant surprise. See, I do think of the little people. Don't let them say I killed myself for love, Sixsmith. That would be too ridiculous. Was infatuated by Eva Crommelink for a blink of an eye. But we both know in our hearts who is the sole love of my short, bright life. Along with this letter, and the rest of the Ewing book, I've made arrangements for a folder containing my completed manuscript to find you at Le Royal. Use the Yanch money to defray publishing costs. Send copies to everyone on the enclosed list. Don't let my family get hold of either of the originals, whatever you do. Pater'll sigh, "It's no Eroica, is it?" and stuff it into a drawer. But it's an incomparable creation. Echoes of Scriabin's White Mass, Stravinsky's Lost Footprints, chromatics of the more lunar Debussy. But truth is, I don't know where it came from. Waking Dream. We'll never write anything 100th as good. Wish I were being immodest, but I'm not. Cloud Atlas Sextet holds my life, is my life. Now I'm a spent firework. But at least I've been a firework. People are obscenities. Would rather be music than a mass of tubes squeezing semi-solids around itself for a few decades before becoming so dribblesome it'll no longer function. Luger here. 13 minutes to go. Feel trepidation, naturally, but my love of this coda is stronger. An electrical thrill that, like Adrian, I know I am to die. Pride that I shall see it through. Certainties. Strip back the beliefs pasted on by governesses, schools, and states, you find indelible truths at one's core. Rome will decline and fall again. Cortez will lay Tenochtitlan to waste again, and later, Ewing will sail again. Adrian will be blown to pieces again. You and I'll sleep under Corsican stars again. I'll come to Bruges again, fall in and out of love with Eva again. You'll read this letter again. The sun'll grow cold again. Nietzsche's gramophone record. When it ends, the old one plays it again, for an eternity of eternities. Time cannot permeate this sabbatical. We do not stay dead long. Once my Luger lets me go, my birth, next time around, will be upon me in a heartbeat. 13 years from now, we'll meet again at Gresham. 10 years later I'll be back in this same room, holding this same gun, composing this same letter, my resolution as perfect as my many-headed sextet. Such elegant certainties comfort me at this quiet hour.
Sunt lacrimae rerum. R.F.
The Pacific Journal of Adam Ewing. Join us. I am sorry to write, no man from either shift braved the first mate's displeasure by attending, but we shall persist in our efforts undiscouraged. Raphael was up the masthead and interrupted our prayers with a treble cry of "Land ahoy!" We ended our worship early and braved dousings of sea spray to watch land emerge from the rocking horizon. Raiatea, Mr. Roderick told us, of the societies. Once again the prophetess's keel crosses the endeavors. Captain Cook himself named the group. I asked if we would be putting ashore. Mr. Roderick affirmed, The captain wants to pay one of the missions a call. The societies loomed larger, and after 3 weeks of oceanic grays and blazing blues, our eyes rejoiced at the moss-drenched mountain faces, aglint with cataracts, daubed with cacophonous jungle. The prophetess cleared 15 fathoms, yet so clear was the water, iridescent corals were visible. I speculated with Henry on how we might prevail upon Captain Molyneux for permission to go ashore, when the very same appeared from the deckhouse, his beard trimmed and forelock oiled. Far from ignoring us, as is his custom, he walked over to us with a smile as friendly as a cutpurse's. "Mr. Ewing, Dr. Goose, would you care to accompany the first mate and I ashore on yonder isle this morning? A settlement of Methodists lies in a bay on the northern coast. Nazareth, they've named it. Gentlemen of inquiring minds may find the place diverting." Henry accepted with enthusiasm, and I did not withhold my consent, though I mistrusted the old raccoon's motivations. "Settled," the captain pronounced. An hour later, the prophetess kedged into Bethlehem Bay, a black sand cove sheltered from trade winds by Cape Nazareth's crook. Ashore was a stratum of cruder thatched dwellings erected on stilts near the waterline, occupied, I correctly assumed, by the baptized Indians. Above these were a dozen timber buildings crafted by civilized hands, and higher still, below the hill's crown, stood a proud church denoted by a white cruciform. The larger of the skiffs was lowered for our benefit. Its four rowers were Guernsey, Bent Nail, and a pair of garter snakes. Mr. Boerhaave donned a hat and waistcoat more suitable for a Manhattan salon than a haul across the surf. We beached with no mishap worse than a good soak, but our sole emissary from the colonists was a Polynesian dog panting under golden jasmine and vermilion trumpet flowers. The shoreline huts and Main Street winding up to the church were devoid of human life. 20 men, 20 muskets, commented Mr. Boerhaave, when the place would be ours by dinner time. Makes you think, eh, sir? Captain Molyneux instructed the rowers to wait in the shade while we call on the king in his counting house. My suspicion that the captain's new graces were skin-deep was confirmed when he found the trading store boarded up, and he vented a fanged oath. "Mayhap," speculated the Dutchman, "the niggers unconverted themselves and ate their pastors for pudding." A bell rang from the church tower, and the captain slapped his forehead. "Damn my eyes, what am I thinking? It's the Sabbath, by God, and these holy shits'll be a-braying in their rickety church." We wound our way up the steep hill at a crawl, our party slowed by Captain Molyneux's gout. I feel a loamy breathlessness when I exert myself. Recalling my vigor on the Chathams, I am worried at how severely the parasite taxes my constitution. We reached Nazareth's house of worship just as the congregation was emerging. The captain removed his hat, boomed a hearty, "Greetings, Jonathan Molyneux, captain of the Prophetess." He indicated our vessel in the bay with a sweep of his hand. The Nazarenes were less effusive, the men awarding us wary nods, their wives and daughters hiding behind fans. Cries of "Fetch Preacher Horrocks!" echoed into the church recesses as its native occupants now poured out to see the visitors. Upwards of 60 adult men and women I counted, of whom around a third were white, garbed in their Sunday best, as could be managed 2 weeks' voyage from the nearest haberdashery. The blacks watched us with bare curiosity. The native women were decently clothed, but more than a few were blighted with goiter. Boys protecting their fair-skinned mistresses from the sun's fierceness with parasols of palm leaves grinned a little. A privileged platoon of Polynesians wore a natty brown shoulder band embroidered with a white crucifix as a uniform of sorts. Now bounded out a cannonball of a man whose clerical garb declaimed his calling. "I," announced the patriarch, am Giles Horrocks, preacher of Bethlehem Bay and representative of the London Missionary Society on Raiatea. State your business, sirs. Be quick about it. Captain Molyneux now extended his introductions to include Mr. Boerhaave of the Dutch Reformist Church, Dr. Henry Goose, physician of the London gentry and late of the Fiji mission, and Mr. Adam Ewing, American notary of letters and law. Now I stood wise to the rogue's game. The names of Preacher Horrocks and Bethlehem Bay are spoken of with respect amongst us peripatetic devout of the South Pacific. We had hoped to celebrate the Sabbath before your altar. The captain looked ruefully at the church. But, alas, contrary winds delayed our arrival. At the very least, I pray your collection plate is not yet closed. Preacher Horrocks scrutinized our captain. You command a godly ship, sir? Captain Molyneux glanced away in an imitation of humility. Neither as godly nor as unsinkable as your church, sir, but yes, Mr. Boerhaave and I do what we can for those souls in our care. 'Tis an unceasing struggle, I am sorry to say. Sailors revert to their wanton ways as soon as our backs are turned. Oh, but Captain, spoke a lady in a lace collar, we have our recidivists in Nazareth, too. You will pardon my husband's caution. Experience teaches us most vessels under so-called Christian flags bring us little but disease and drunkards. We must assume guilt until innocence is established. The captain bowed again. Madam, I can grant no pardon where no offense was given nor any taken. Your prejudices against those Visigoths of the sea are amply warranted, Mrs. Horrocks. Mr. Boerhaave entered the exchange. But I won't tolerate a drop of grog aboard our prophetess, however the men holler. And oh, they holler, but I holler back, the only spirit you need is the Holy Spirit. And I holler it louder and longer. The charade was having its desired effect. Preacher Horrocks presented his two daughters and three sons, all of whom were born here in Nazareth. The girls might have stepped from a ladies' school, but the boys were tanned as Kanakas beneath their starched collars. Loath as I was to be lassoed into the captain's masquerade, I was curious to learn more of this island theocracy and let the current of events carry me along. Soon our party proceeded to the Horrocks' parsonage, which dwelling would not shame any petty Southern Hemisphere consul. It included a large drawing room with glass windows and tulip wood furniture, a necessary room, two shacks for servants, and a dining room, where presently we were served with fresh vegetables and tender pork. The table stood with each leg immersed in a dish of water. Mrs. Horrocks explained, "Ants. One bane of Bethlehem. Their drowned bodies must be emptied periodically, lest they build a causeway of themselves." I complimented the domicile. Preacher Horrocks, the lady of the house, told us with pride, was trained as a carpenter in the Shire of Gloucester. Most of Nazareth was built by his hands. The pagan mind is impressed with material display, you see. He thinks, how spick and span are Christians' houses? How dirty our hovels. How generous the white god is. How mean is ours. In this way, one more convert is brought to the Lord. If I could but live my life over, opined Mr. Boerhaave, without the slightest blush, I should choose the missionary's selfless path. Preacher, we see here a well-established mission with roots struck deep. But how does one begin the work of conversion upon a benighted beach where no Christian foot ever trod? Preacher Horrocks gazed beyond his interrogator to a future lecture hall. Tenacity, sir. Compassion and law. 15 years ago, our reception in this bay was not so cordial as your own, sir. That anvil-shaped island you see to the west, thither? Bora Bora, the blacks call it, but Sparta is an apter name, so warlike were its warriors. On the beach of Bethlehem Cove we fought, and some of us fell. Had our pistols not won that first week's battle as well, the Raiatea mission should have remained a dream. But it was the will of the Lord that we light his beacon here and keep it burning. After a half year, we could bring over our women folk from Tahiti. I regret the native deaths, but once the Indians saw how God protects his flock, why, even the Spartans were begging us to send preachers. Mrs. Horrocks took up the story. When the pox began its deadly work, the Polynesians needed succor, both spiritual and material. Our compassion then brought the heathen to the holy font. Now 'tis the turn of holy law to keep our flock from temptation and marauding seamen. Whalers particularly despise us for teaching the women chastity and modesty. Our men must keep our firearms well oiled. Yet if shipwrecked, noted the captain, I'll warrant those same spouters beg fate to wash 'em up on beaches where those same cursed missionaries have brought the Gospels, do they not? Assent was indignant and universal. Mrs. Horrocks answered my query about the enforcement of law and order in this lonesome outpost of progress. Our church council, my husband and three wise elders, passes those laws we deem necessary with guidance of prayer. Our guards of Christ, certain natives who prove themselves faithful servants of the church, enforce these laws in return for credit at my husband's store. Vigilance, unflagging vigilance is vital, or by next week... Mrs. Horrocks shuddered as apostasy's phantoms danced a hula on her grave. The meal over, we adjourned to the parlor, where a native boy served us cool tea in pleasing gourd cups. Captain Molyneux asked, "Sir, how does one fund a mission as industrious as yours?" Preacher Horrocks felt the breeze change and scrutinized the captain afresh. "Arrowroot, starch, and coconut oil defray costs, Captain. The blacks work on our plantation to pay for the school, Bible study, and church. In a week, God will it, we shall have an abundant harvest of copra." I asked if the Indians worked of their own free will. "Of course," exclaimed Mrs. Horrocks. "If they succumb to sloth, they know the gods of Christ will punish them for it." I wished to ask about these punitive incentives, but Captain Molyneux snatched back the conversation. "Your missionary society ship carries these perishable commodities back around the Horn to London." "Your conjecture is correct, Captain." "Have you considered, Preacher Horrocks, how more secure your mission's secular footing, and by extension its spiritual one, would be if you had a reliable market closer to the societies?" The preacher told the serving boy to quit the room. "I have considered this question at length. But where? Mexico's markets are small and prone to banditry. Cape Town is a marriage of corrupt excisemen and greedy Afrikaners. The South China Seas swarm with ruthless, saucy pirates. The Batavian Dutch bleed one dry. No offense, Mr. Boerhaafer." The captain indicated himself. "Mr. Ewing is a denizen of..." He paused to unveil his proposal. "San Francisco, California. You will know of its growth from a paltry town of 700 souls to a metropolis of... 250,000? No census can keep count. Celestials, Chileans, Mexicans, Europeans, foreigners of all colors are flooding in by the day. An egg, Mr. Ewing? Kindly inform us how much is presently paid for an egg in San Francisco."
$1, so my wife wrote to me.
$1 Yankee dollar for a common egg.
Captain Molyneux's smile is that of a mummified crocodile I once saw hanging in a Louisiana dry goods store. Surely, this gives a man of your acumen some pause for thought. Mrs. Horrocks was nobody's fool. All the gold will be mined out soon. Aye, madam, but the hungry, clamoring, enriched city of San Francisco, only 3 weeks away by a trim schooner like my prophetess, will remain, and its destiny is clear as crystal. San Francisco shall become the London, the Rotterdam, and the New York of the Pacific Ocean. Our Capitaine de la Casa picked his teeth with a bluefin bone. Do you believe, Mr. Ewing, commodities grown in our plantations may fetch a fair price in your city? How strange 'tis hearing our modest township so upheld, both of the moment and after the gold rush? My truthfulness was a card Captain Molyneux had played to his devious advantage, but I would not lie to spite him any more than I would to aid him. I do. Giles Horrocks removed his clergyman's collar. Would you care to accompany me to my office, Jonathan? I am rather proud of its roof. I designed it myself to withstand the dreadful typhoon. Is that so, Giles? Replied Captain Molyneux. Lead the way. Notwithstanding the name of Dr. Henry Goose was unknown in Nazareth until this morning, once the wives of Bethlehem learned a famed English surgeon was ashore, they recalled all manner of ailments and beat a crowded path to the parsonage. So odd to be in the presence of the fairer sex again after so many days penned up with the uglier one. My friend's generosity could not turn away a single caller, so Mrs. Horrocks's salon was commandeered as his consultation room and draped with linen to provide appropriate screens. Mr. Boerhaave returned to the prophetess to see about making more space in the hold. I begged the Horrocks's leave to explore Bethlehem Bay, but its beach was unbearably hot, and its sand flies pestilential, so I retraced our steps up the main street towards the church, whence issued the sound of psalmody. I intended to join in the afternoon worship. Not a soul, not a dog, not even a native stirred the Sabbath stillness. I peered into the dim church, and so thick was the smoke within, I feared, erroneously, the building was aflame. The singing was now over and substituted by choruses of coughing. 50 dark backs faced me, and I realized the air was thick with the smoke, not of fire nor incense, but raw cut tobacco, for every man-jack of them was puffing on a pipe. A rotund wight stood in the pulpit sermonizing in that hybrid accent, Antipodean Cockney. This show of informal religiosity did not offend until the content of the sermon became apparent. I quote, "So it came to pass, see, St. Peter, aye, him who Mr. Jesus called Sweeter Peter Piper, he cameth from Rome, and he taughteth them hooking-nosed Jews in Palestine what was what with the old baccy. And this is what I'm teaching you now, see." Here he broke off to give guidance to an individual. "Nah, tar baby, you're doing it all wrong. See, you load your baccy in the fat end. Aye, that one, see? Oh, Jesus sneezed. How many times I told you, this is the stem, this is the damn bowl. Do it like mudfish next to you. Nah, let me show you." A sallow, stooping wight leant against a cabinet, containing, I later verified, hundreds of holy Bibles printed in Polynesian. I must request one as a souvenir ere our departure, watching the smoky proceedings. I made myself known to him in whispers so as not to distract the smokers from their sermon. The young man introduced himself as Wagstaff and explained the pulpit's occupant was the headmaster of the Nazareth Smoking School. I confessed such an academy was unknown to me. An idea of Father Upwards at the Tahitian Mission. You must understand, sir, your typical Polynesian spurns industry because he's got no reason to value money. If I hungry, says he, I go pick me some or catch me some. If I cold, I tell woman weave. Idle hands, Mr. Ewing, and we both know what work the devil finds for them. But by instilling in the slothful so-and-sos a gentle craving for this harmless leaf, we give him an incentive to earn money, so he can buy his baccy. Not liquor, mind, just baccy, from the Mission Trading Post. Ingenious, wouldn't you say? How could I disagree? The light ebbs away. I hear children's voices, exotic avian octaves, the surf pounding the cove. Henry is grumbling at his cufflinks. Mrs. Horrocks, whose hospitality Henry and I are enjoying tonight, has sent her maid to inform us dinner is served. Monday, the 9th of December. A continuance of yesterday's narrative. After the smoking school was dismissed, several of the students were swaying and nauseous, but their teacher, an itinerant tobacco trader, assured us they'll be hooked like pufferfish in no time. The back of the heat was broken, though Cape Nazareth still broiled in glowing sunshine. Mr. Wagstaff strolled with me along the wooded arm of land shouldering northwards from Bethlehem Bay. The youngest son of a Gravesend curate, my guide had been drawn to the missionary's vocation since infancy. The society, by arrangement with Preacher Horrocks, sent him hither to wed a widow of Nazareth, Eliza, nee Mapple, and be a father to her son Daniel. He arrived on these shores last May. What fortune, I declared, to dwell in such an Eden, but my pleasantry punctured the young man's spirits. So I believed in my first days, sir, but now I don't rightly know. I mean, Eden's a spick-and-span place, but every living thing runs wild here. It bites and scratches so. A pagan brought to God is a soul saved, I know it, but the sun never stops burning, and the waves and stones are always so bright, my eyes ache till dusk comes. Times are I'd give anything for a North Sea fog. The place puts a straining on our souls, to be truthful, Mr. Ewing. My wife's been here since she was a small girl, but that doesn't make it easier for her. You'd think the savages would be grateful. I mean, we school them, heal them, bring employment and eternal life. Oh, they say, please, sir, and thank you, sir, prettily enough, but you feel nothing. Wagstaff pounded his heart. Here. Aye, look like Eden it might, but Raiatea is a fallen place, same as everywhere, aye, no snakes, but the devil plies his trade here as much as anywhere else. The ants. Ants get everywhere. In your food, your clothes, your nose even. Until we convert these accursed ants, these islands will never be truly ours. We arrived at his modest dwelling, crafted by his wife's first husband. Mr. Wagstaff did not invite me in, but went inside to fetch a flask of water for our walk. I took a turn around the modest front garden, where a black gardener was hoeing. I asked what he was growing. David is dumb, a woman called to me from the doorway, dressed in a loosened, grubby pinafore. I am afraid I can only describe her appearance and manner as slovenly. Dumb as a stone. You're the English doctor staying in the Horrockses. I explained I was an American notary and asked if I might be addressing Mrs. Wagstaff. My wedding bands and marriage lines say so, yes. I said Dr. Goose was holding an ad hoc surgery at the Horrockses, if she wished to consult with him. I assured her of Henry's excellence as a physician. Excellent enough to spirit me away, restore the years I've wasted here, and set me up in London with a stipend of £300 per annum. Such a request was beyond my friend's powers, I admitted. Then your excellent physician can do nothing for me, sir. I heard giggles in the bushes beyond me, turned around and saw a host of little black boys. I was curious to note so many light-skinned issue of cross-racial unions. I ignored the children and turned back to see a white boy of 12 or 13, as grubby as his mother, slip by Mrs. Wagstaff, who did not attempt to waylay him. Her son frolicked as naked as his native playmates. "Ho there, young fellow," I reprimanded. "Won't you get a sunstroke running about in that state?" The boy's blue eyes held a feral glint, and his answer, barked in a Polynesian tongue, baffled me as much as it amused the pickaninnies, who flew off like a flock of greenfinches. Mr. Wagstaff followed in the boy's wake, much agitated. "Daniel! Come back! Daniel! I know you hear me! I'll lash you! Do you hear? I'll lash you!" He turned back to his wife. "Mrs. Wagstaff, do you want your son to grow up a savage? At the very least, make the boy wear clothes. Whatever will Mr. Ewing be thinking?" Mrs. Wagstaff's contempt for her young husband, if bottled, could have been vended as rat poison. "Mr. Ewing will think whatever Mr. Ewing will think. Then tomorrow he will leave on his handsome schooner, taking his thinkings with him. Unlike you and I, Mr. Wagstaff, who will die here. Soon, I pray God." She turned to me. "My husband could not complete his schooling, sir, so it is my sorry lot to explain the obvious 10 times a day. Averse to seeing Mr. Wagstaff's humiliation at the hands of his wife, I gave a noncommittal bow and withdrew outside the fence. I heard male indignation trampled by female scorn and concentrated my attention on a nearby bird, whose refrain to my ears sounded thus, "Toby isn't telling, no, Toby isn't telling." My guide joined me, most visibly glum. "Beg pardon, Mr. Ewing. Mrs. Wagstaff's nerves are fearful frayed today. She don't sleep much on account of the heat and flies." I assured him the eternal afternoon of the South Seas taxes the sturdiest physiologies. We walked under slimy fronds, along the tapering headland, noxious with fertility, and furry caterpillars plump as my thumb dropped from talons of exquisite heliconia. The young man narrated how the mission had assured Mr. Wagstaff's family of his intended's impeccable breeding. Preacher Horrocks had married them a day after his arrival in Nazareth, while the enchantment of the tropics still dazzled his eyes. Why Eliza Mapple had consented to such an arranged union remains uncertain. Henry speculates the latitude and clime unhinges the weaker sex and renders them pliable. Mr. Wagstaff's bride's infirmities, true age, and Daniel's obstreperous nature came to light scarcely after their signatures on the wedding documents had dried. The stepfather had tried beating his new charge, but this led to such wicked recriminations from both mother and stepson that he knew not where to turn. Far from helping Mr. Wagstaff, Preacher Horrocks chastised him for a weakling, and the truth is, 9 days out of 10 he is wretched as Job. Whatever Mr. Wagstaff's misfortunes, could any compare to a parasitic worm gnawing his cerebral canals? Thinking to distract the brooding youth with matters more logistical, I asked why such an abundance of Bibles lay untouched, and read only by book lice, to tell the truth, in the church. Preacher Horrocks should by rights tell it. But briefly, the Batavia Bay Mission first translated the Lord's Word into Polynesian, and native missionaries using those Bibles achieved so many conversions that Elder Whitlock, one of Nazareth's founders what's dead now, convinced the mission to repeat the experiment here. He'd once been apprenticed to a Highgate engraver, see. So with guns and tools, the first missionaries brought a printing press, paper, bottles of ink, trays of type, and reams of paper. Within 10 days of founding Bethlehem Bay, 3,000 primers was printed for mission schools, before they'd dug the gardens even.
Nazareth Gospels came next and spread the word from the societies to the cooks to Tonga. But now the press is rusted up. We've got thousands of Bibles begging for an owner. And why? I could not guess. Not enough Indians. Ships bring disease dust here. The blacks breathe it in and they swell up sick and fall like spinny tops. We teach the survivors about monogamy and marriage, but their unions aren't fruitful. I found myself wondering how many months had passed since last Mr. Wagstaff smiled. To kill what you'd cherish and cure, he opined, that seems to be the way of things. The path ended down by the sea at a crumbling ingot of black coral, 20 yards in length and in height, 2 men. A marae, this is called, Mr. Wagstaff informed me. All over the South Seas you see him, I'm told. We scrambled up, and I had a fine view of the prophetess, an easy dip away for a lusty swimmer. Finbar emptied a vat over the side, and I spied Atua's black silhouette atop the mizzen, furling the 4 skysail lifts. I inquired after the origins and purpose of the marae, and Mr. Wagstaff obliged with brevity. Just 1 generation ago, the Indians did their screaming and bloodletting and sacrificing to their false idols right on these stones where we're standing. My thoughts went back to the banquet beach on Chatham Isle. The Christ guards gives any black who sets foot here now a hefty flogging. Or would do. The native children don't even know the names of the old idols no more. It's all rats' nests and rubble now. That's where all beliefs turn to one day. Rats' nests and rubble. Plumeria petals and scent enwrapped me. My neighbor at the dinner table was Mrs. Derbyshire, a widow well into her 6th decade, as bitter and hard as green acorns. I confess to a disrelish for Americans, she told me. They killed my treasured Uncle Samuel, a colonel in His Majesty's artillery in the War of 1812. I gave my unwanted condolences, but added that notwithstanding my own treasured uncle was killed by Englishmen in the same conflict, some of my closest friends were Britons. The doctor laughed too loudly and ejaculated, "Hurrah, Ewing!" Mrs. Horrocks seized the rudder of conversation ere we ran onto reefs. "Your employers evince great faith in your talents, Mr. Ewing, to entrust you with business necessitating such a long and arduous voyage." I replied that, yes, I was a senior enough notary to be entrusted with my present assignment, but a junior enough scrivener to be obligated to accept the same. Knowing Clucks rewarded my humility. After Preacher Horrocks had said grace over the bowls of turtle soup and invoked God's blessing on his new business venture with Captain Molyneux, he sermonized upon a much-beloved topic as we ate. "I have always unswervingly held that God, in our civilizing world, manifests himself not in the miracles of the biblical age, but in progress. It is progress that leads humanity up the ladder towards the Godhead. No Jacob's ladder this, no, but rather civilization's ladder, if you will. Highest of all the races on this ladder stands the Anglo-Saxon. The Latins are a rung or 2 below. Lower still are Asiatics. A hard-working race, none can deny, yet lacking our Aryan bravery. Sinologists insist they once aspired to greatness, but where is your yellow-hued Shakespeare, eh? Or your almond-eyed Da Vinci? Point made, point taken. Lower down we have the Negro. Good-tempered ones may be trained to work profitably, though a rambunctious one is the devil incarnate. The American Indian, too, is capable of useful chores on the Californian barrios. Is that not so, Mr. Ewing? I said, 'tis so. Now, our Polynesian. The visitor to Tahiti, Hawaii, or Bethlehem for that matter, will concur that the Pacific Islander may, with careful instruction, acquire the ABC of literacy, numeracy, and piety, thereby surpassing the Negroes to rival Asiatics in industriousness. Henry interrupted to note that the Maori have risen to the DEF of mercantilism, diplomacy, and colonialism. Proves my point. Last, lowest, and least come those irreclaimable races, the Australian Aboriginals, Patagonians, various African peoples, etc., just one rung up from the great apes, and so obdurate to progress that, like mastodons and mammoths, I am afraid a speedy knocking off the ladder. After their cousins, the Guanches, Canary Islanders, and Tasmanians, is the kindest prospect. You mean, Captain Molyneux finished his soup, extinction? I do, Captain, I do. Nature's law and progress move as one. Our own century shall witness humanity's tribes fulfill those prophecies writ in their racial traits. The superior shall relegate the overpopulous savages to their natural numbers. Unpleasant scenes may ensue, but men of intellectual courage must not flinch. A glorious order shall follow, when all races shall know and I embrace their place in God's ladder of civilization. Bethlehem Bay offers a glimpse of the coming dawn. Amen to that, preacher, replied Captain Molyneux. One Mr. Gosling, fiancé of Preacher Horrocks's eldest daughter, wrung his hands in oleaginous admiration. If I dare be so bold, sir, it strikes me as almost, yes, a deprivation to let your theorem go unpublished, sir. The Horrocks ladder of civilization would set the Royal Society alight. Preacher Horrocks said, No, Mr. Gosling, my work is here. The Pacific must find itself another Descartes, another Cuvier. Wise of you, preacher. Henry clapped a flying insect and examined its remains. To keep your theory to yourself. Our host could not conceal his irritation. How so? Why, under scrutiny, it is obvious a theorem is redundant when a simple law suffices. What law would that be, sir? The first of Goose's two laws of survival. It runs thus, the weak are meat, the strong do eat. But your simple law is blind to the fundamental mystery. Why do white races hold dominion over the world? Henry chuckled and loaded an imaginary musket, aimed down its barrel, narrowed his eye, then startled the company with a bang, bang, bang. See? Got him before he blew his blowpipe. Mrs. Derbyshire uttered a dismayed, Oh. Henry shrugged. Where is the fundamental mystery? Preacher Horrocks had lost his good humor. Your implication is that white races rule the globe not by divine grace, but by the musket. But such an assertion is merely the same mystery dressed up in borrowed clothes. How is it that the musket came to the white man and not, say, the Eskimo or the pygmy, if not by august will of the Almighty? Henry obliged. Our weaponry was not dropped onto our laps one morning. It is not manna from Sinai's skies. Since Agincourt, the white man has refined and evolved the gunpowder sciences until our modern armies may field muskets by the tens of thousands. Aha, you will ask, yes, but why us Aryans? Why not the unipeds of Ur or the mandrakes of Mauritius? Because, preacher, of all the world's races, our love, or rather our rapacity, for treasure, gold, spices, and dominion, oh, most of all, sweet dominion, is the keenest, the hungriest, the most unscrupulous. This rapacity, yes, powers our progress. For ends infernal or divine I know not. Nor do you know, sir. Nor do I overly care. I feel only gratitude that my Maker cast me on the winning side. Henry's forthrightness was misconstrued as incivility, and Preacher Horrocks, the Napoleon of his equatorial Elba, was pinkening with indignation. I complimented our hostess's soup, though in truth my craving for vermicide makes it difficult to ingest any but the plainest fare, and asked if the turtles were caught on nearby beaches or imported from afar. Later, lying abed in the muggy darkness, eavesdropped by geckos, Henry confided that the day's surgery had been a parade of hysterical, sun-baked women who need no medicine but hosiers, milliners, bonnet-makers, perfumeries, and sundry trappings of their sex. His consultations, he elaborated, were one part medicine, nine parts tittle-tattle. They swear their husbands are tupping the native women and live in mortal fear they'll catch something. Handkerchiefs aired in rotation. His confidences made me uneasy, and I ventured that Henry might practice a little reserve when disagreeing with our host. Dearest Adam, I was practicing reserve, and more than a little. I longed to shout this at the old fool. Why tinker with the plain truth that we hurry the darker races to their graves in order to take their land and its riches? Wolves don't sit in their caves, concocting crapulous theories of race to justify devouring a flock of sheep. Intellectual courage? True intellectual courage is to dispense with these fig leaves and admit all peoples are predatory. But white predators, with our deadly duet of disease, dust, and firearms, are exemplars of predacity par excellence, and what of it? It upsets me that a dedicated healer and gentle Christian can succumb to such cynicism. I asked to hear Goose's second law of survival. Henry grinned in the dark and cleared his throat. The second law of survival states that there is no second law. Eat or be eaten. That's it. He began snoring soon after, but my worm kept me awake until the stars began weakening. Geckos fed and padded softly over my sheet. Dawn was sweating and scarlet as passion fruit. Male and female natives alike drudged up Main Street to the church plantations atop the hill, where they worked until the afternoon heat was intolerable. Before the skiff came to take Henry and me back to the prophetess, I went to watch the workers plucking weeds from the copra. Peradventure it fell to young Mr. Wagstaff to be their overseer this morning, and he had a native boy bring us coconut milk. I withheld from asking after his family, and he did not mention them. He carries a whip, but I rarely employ it myself. That's what the guard of Christ the King are for. I just watch the watchers, he said. Three of these dignitaries watched their fellows, leading hymns, land shanties, and reprimanding slackers. Mr. Wagstaff was less inclined to conversation than yesterday, and let my pleasantries lapse into silence broken only by sounds of the jungle and laborers. You're thinking, aren't you, that we've made slaves out of free peoples? I avoided the question by saying Mr. Horrocks had explained their labors paid for the benefits of progress brought by the mission. Mr. Wagstaff did not hear me. There exists a tribe of ants called the Slave Maker. These insects raid the colonies of common ants, steal eggs back to their own nests, and after they hatch, why, the stolen slaves become workers of the greater empire and never even dream they were once stolen. Now, if you ask me, Lord Jehovah crafted these ants as a model, Mr. Ewing. Mr. Wagstaff's gaze was gravid with the ancient future. For them with the eyes to see it. People of shifting character unnerve me, and Mr. Wagstaff was one such. I made my excuses and proceeded to my next port of call, Videlicet, the schoolroom.
Here infant Nazarenes of both hues study scripture, arithmetic, and their ABCs. Mrs. Derbyshire teaches the boys and Mrs. Horrocks the girls. In the afternoon, the white children have an additional 3 hours tutelage in a curriculum appropriate to their station, though Daniel Wagstaff, for one, appears immune to his educator's wiles, while their darker playmates join their parents in the fields before the daily vespers. A short review was staged in my honor. 10 girls, 5 white, 5 black, recited a holy commandment apiece. Then I was treated to